we're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart. Hugh McKay, one of Australia's leading social researchers, begins his latest book, Australia Reimagined, with these words. Sometimes, when I talk to people about the state of the nation, they wonder if I'm some kind of prophet of doom. Nothing could be further from my intent. I love Australia, and am full of optimism about its future, especially as the rising generation of young Australians, more nimble, adaptable and open-minded than the rest of us, gradually take over. But if, as I suspect, we are in more trouble than many of us realise, the best starting point for course correction is to acknowledge where we are now and how we got here. Where we are is this. We're disappointed in our political leadership. We've lost faith in once respected institutions like the church. Education standards are faltering, families are fractured. The proliferation of social media is leading, paradoxically, to more loneliness and less privacy. Yet, Hugh McKay remains optimistic and offers a vision, a reimagining of Australia as a more compassionate society. But first, we sent our producer Karen Tong out to ask people if they could reimagine Australia, what they'd keep, what they'd toss, and why.
I would definitely focus more on equality for all and a fair distribution of wealth. So I think we need a fairer playing field for all and inclusivity for all, really.
Yeah, first of all, maybe like the internet, because internet's quite slow. That is one thing. I love that there's multicultural, but not all the time. But yeah, if I compare my country and Australia, there's the big differences.
Okay, let's start with what we would keep. People.
Yeah.
Positive people from all around the world.
What so friendly keep? And...
Yeah. Nature, we would keep nature.
Yeah.
What we wouldn't keep, food. Fast food, junk food, what else? I don't know.
I don't know.
We love Australia, I think, so...
Yeah.
Oh, gee, that's a hard question. Well, I'd certainly keep our beautiful, you know, parks and gardens, our beaches, our lovely climate. All the natural beauty around Australia is gorgeous. The things I'd change is probably the divisive nature of Australia at the moment. I would much prefer us to be far more united. We used to be united, but we seem to be running two camps within Australia these days. So if we had a more unified view as to where Australia would go, that would be better for me.
Hugh McKay was a speaker at the Sydney Writers' Festival this year. And while he was in the city, he came to our studio to have this conversation. We started with this. What are the key indicators that we're not doing too well as a society?
I think there's a kind of central truth about contemporary Australia which disturbs me deeply. It involves two separate sets of data which are not often brought together. On the one hand, it's the story of social fragmentation. I think we are a more socially divided and fragmented society than we've ever been. More people feeling a sense of social isolation, alienation. Some public health experts are now saying that loneliness is a greater public health, greater risk to our public health than obesity. Where did that come from? Well, it came from a whole lot of changes that we've brought. It's not something that's been done to us. We've done it to ourselves. High rate of relationship breakdown, low birth rate, great busyness, mobility, increased mobility, heavier than ever reliance on impersonal media of personal communication, the so-called social media, increasing income inequality. All of these things are creating the sense of a place where I'd better look out for myself.
What's the other?
The other fact is that we've got a mental health crisis. We have an epidemic of anxiety and of depression. And that, to me, is not mysterious at all. When you have, as we had in the last 12 months, 2 million Australians being diagnosed with anxiety disorders, you can look at individual factors, specific factors in individual cases, and say, oh, this person is anxious because of rent stress or because of job insecurity or because of a relationship breakdown or loss of faith. Or there are all sorts of things that make people anxious. But when you've got epidemic proportions, I think you have to look at the society. We need to live in communities that sustain us and nurture us, protect us, give us a sense of identity. When we feel a bit cut off from the herd, anxiety goes up.
So you're putting this anxiety epidemic and the fragmentation together,
yes, as
in some form of sort of cause and effect. Is it that we're more anxious, or is it just that we have a label for this now?
Partly that, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure part of the formal medical diagnosis of anxiety is that we're more alert to it and looking out for it, same with depression. But I think when you're talking about these numbers, one in three Australians likely to have an episode of mental illness sometime in their lives. Yes, that might be that we recognise it more, but that's
still
a huge number,
it?
Simon. It's so big, I don't think we can say, oh, it's just that we're more alert to it.
No.
There's more of it.
You also talk about rates of attempted suicide, which are astonishingly,
yes,
high.
The good news is the rate is coming down a bit, but the numbers are terrible. Between 65 and 70,000 Australians attempt suicide every year. Now, that's the population of a city like Albury, who decided they want to end it. Now, most of those attempts are not successful, but that's a lot of Australians deciding they're going to check out.
And you make the point that all of this is happening at the same time that we've had incredible, like, long-term economic growth, continuous economic growth, 26 years. Clearly, that isn't the thing that's going to solve the problems that are deep in our hearts.
I'm no economist, but I think there's a contributing factor here. The obsession with economic growth fuels the obsession with material wealth and prosperity, which is again fueling our sense of individualism. It's a kind of an anti-communitarian philosophy in a way, but also here, as in so many other societies through history, all of this 26 years of, I mean, there's some controversy about whether it is 26 years of...
But it's a long time.
But it's a long time, has made us more unequal. So we've seen enormous growth in the number of wealthy Australians and enormous growth in the number of poor, underemployed, welfare-dependent Australians. So... The top 1% of Australians control more wealth than the bottom 70% of Australians. I mean, this is I think the evidence is overwhelming, Simon. I mean, the so-called trickle-down effect clearly does not work. Or if it did, we would see a very different kind of distribution of wealth in contemporary Australia. And I think it does remind us that through history, if you get too much concentration of wealth at the top and serious problems of economic struggle, not just at the bottom, but sort of in the bottom half, in many societies... Yeah, trouble's coming, exactly. Yeah. In many societies, that's the recipe for revolution.
Now, as you write, I can sort of hear you trying to not completely reject modern technology as a means of communication, but you have grave reservations about it, don't you? Is there any antidote to this incredibly pervasive element of our lives? I'm looking for help here. help us out here.
Yes, yes. Well, it requires enormous discipline. And I think over the next two generations, we will correct ourselves about it. We always go overboard about new technology. There was a time when people would come home from work and turn on the television and sit in front of it until bedtime because it was so new and amazing. Now it flickers away in the corner and we take bits out of it rather like the fridge, which was once a miracle. So I think we'll get this into perspective. But in the short term, it's creating serious difficulties for us because it's so clever, it's so convenient, it's so almost miraculous that of course we're seduced by it.
Yeah.
But we have to recognise what it's doing. Apart from carving out time that would otherwise be spent in face-to-face contact, it's also, of course, training us to communicate with each other in a way that strips the process of all the nuance, which even now when we're in a studio talking to each other, there's a lot more going on than the listeners can hear. I mean, there's the whole body language thing. There's posture and gestures and facial expressions and what the listener can hear, tone of voice, rate of speech, all the things that imply meaning that's not just in the words. But when we go into the digital world, it's just in, I mean, there are emojis, but that's a bit primitive.
They don't always serve the function.
So it's a very stripped-down form of communication. The other thing is that there's a paradox right at the heart of it, Simon, which is it seems to be connecting us, but at the same time it's making it easier than ever for us to stay apart, which is why, particularly with young people, the latest research on heavy use of social media shows that it's associated with feelings of loneliness and depression. And that shouldn't surprise us because even though messages are being exchanged, it's just a data transfer. It's not, there's no human presence. There's no richness in it. No wonder kids who, or adults for that matter, who spend a lot of time on their screen actually feel isolated. You could see the same thing in workplaces. In workplaces where people are mostly interacting with the screen all day, they have less sense of loyalty to the employer, less sense of connection to the workplace, of course.
One of the things that someone like myself will be interested in too will be as we get this rise in anxiety and this fragmentation, we are noticing at least the corresponding rejection of faith as a kind of foundation of many people's lives.
Mm.
What do you make of that? And what links do you draw between those two things?
Mm. It's a huge conundrum, Simon, because if you look at some of the primary social indicators about contemporary Australia, you would say this is a troubled, I'd even say wounded, perhaps even sick society. I mean, epidemics of mental illness, epidemic of obesity, etc. All of these things are symptoms. Mm. So you would say a society in that kind of state is ripe for some kind of embrace of faith in a power greater than ourselves, whether we call that God or something else. And yet the opposite seems to be happening. Now, I think this is a transitional phase because I think a society in as much trouble as we are will actually embrace faith of one kind or another in the future. In the short term, the problem is that the Christian Church, and that, of course, is the dominant religion in Australia, 52% of Australians at the last census identified themselves as Christian. You have to go a long way to the next one, which is Buddhism. Our fastest growing religion is Hinduism, but it's still only 1.5% of the population, or 2.5% of the population. So why this disconnect? And I think, unfortunately, part of the answer is that the church as an institution has really lost its way and has lost its connection with the broader society. And while we're talking about this, we ought to bracket this with most other institutions.
Yes, yeah, so commercial institutions,
banks,
educational institutions. Yeah. Banks aren't doing so well at the moment.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a loss of
politics,
faith, isn't
trade
there, in
unions.
Institutions generally.
Who can we trust? This is a big question in our society. Now, you would have thought that the church, because of the fundamental values of Jesus, which are enshrined in the Christian religion, you would have thought the church would be exempt from this sense of we can't trust them anymore. But here is a problem with institutions. Institutions, in a way, I mean, why do we have institutions? We create institutions to preserve our values, to create a framework for us conducting our lives in an orderly way, whether it's our finances or our spiritual life or our politics, whatever it is. But when those institutions become big and powerful, just like individuals who become powerful, they are susceptible to corruption. And I think we've seen enough evidence, even just in the Royal Commission on Child Sexual Abuse in Institutions, that alone, quite apart from all the things we hear about various forms of financial corruption and other morally dubious behaviour, it looks as though the church as an institution has been corrupted in the same way as the banks as an institution, or politics as an institution can be corrupted. And the manifestation of the corruption is that the institution becomes inward-looking, obsessed with its own power and wealth, and more interested in the protection of the institution than in making a connection with the society that allowed that institution or even encouraged it in the beginning.
I think, well, historically that's been the case for the church for sure. As it's become closer and closer to power, inevitably there's corruption and sort of misdirection that comes in. Yes. I'm interested in whether you think that these institutions that include the church have a way back to, you know, restoring, I guess, faith in them by the general population.
No one knows, but it's a very big question. And I think the most likely short-term response to this loss of faith in institutions is that we'll look for alternatives. So we'll look, in the case of the banks, we'll look for alternative, like we might see a revival of the credit union or the building society, or, you know, a more cooperative, community-connected way of dealing with money and getting financial advice and so on. In the case of the church, it's already happening, of course, and I think we could pretty easily predict a huge growth in the so-called house church movement. In China, for example, where there are 100 million Christians, most of them don't go to a building called a church. They meet in house churches. So I think no one knows the number of people who attend house church meetings in Australia, but let's assume that will grow and some of that will then become institutionalized. But it's always a balancing act. And when you talk to Australians about religion, they make a very clear distinction between institutional religion, big cross, and the faith of the individual believer, big tick, even among people who don't have any religious faith. They admire it and often envy it.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. Hugh McKay's vision of social cohesion grounded in compassion and respect is beautiful, no doubt. But I asked him, don't we need something to impel us towards this vision?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think it's a very hard discipline for people to adopt. I mean, in the book I talk about compassion as a cool mental discipline. I think it's very important for people to realize that when Jesus, for example, was talking about loving your enemies. And when we talk about showing charity or compassion towards people we don't agree with and don't even, how could you possibly love someone you didn't like? Well, let's rethink. This has nothing to do with the emotions. This is a commitment to a way of life that says we are all one, we're all part of each other, and so when I encounter you, the only appropriate way to deal with you is with compassion and kindness and respect, because after all, you're me and I'm you. We're all in this thing together. Now, I can say that as an intellectual proposition, and people will hear it, and some will agree, and some will say you're off the, you know, you're off the planet, too hard. You know, when you say love your neighbours, you haven't met my neighbours,
right.
All that sort of stuff. And so, if you look at the role of religion in society, the role of religious faith, it seems to me it is primarily. Other people have different views about the purpose of religion, but speaking as a social analyst, I'd say its purpose is to promote through faith in a higher power that idea that the divine aspect of human nature is compassion.
Yeah, and that because of that divine aspect of the human nature, there's a worth to every individual that you're called to treat in a very special way. So that things like that gross inequality that you talk about, things like the terrible mistreatment of people seeking refuge in our country, so that it sort of goes against that concept that every person is so precious and valuable because they have this worth bestowed upon them by God. It's not because they're particularly valuable or productive or beautiful or whatever it might be. They have that. Occasionally, Hugh, I get the sense that you don't seem to think that the content of belief matters very much. Like, and that might be an area we slightly disagree on, or perhaps profoundly disagree on. Much of what you write about Christianity seems to present two possibilities: you're either kind of a fundamentalist on the one hand, or a completely liberal Christian who thinks everything in the Bible is kind of metaphorical. Whereas I would argue there's an enormous amount of space in between those two things. How do you respond to that?
I agree with you. There are places in the book where I'm probably a bit black and white about that. I'm very, very resistant to literal fundamentalism, having grown up in that tradition myself. But I acknowledge that there's a very broad spectrum. And at the extreme liberal end, you'd question whether this is Christianity at all. And yes, I'm sure most people are in the middle.
I'm often left wondering, once you take away the belief, whether you can sustain that kind of view. It's left. We're yet to discover that, aren't we?
Yes, how can I put this? I suppose I'm charitably disposed towards people who want to get onto the pathway of compassion and mutual respect and the oneness of humanity, even without a religious context.
Yeah.
I think there is some possibility of convergence between people of goodwill who've come to those conclusions and people of faith who've come to the same conclusions. The advantage for the people of faith is that they have the faith, that they have the larger perspective for all of this. And that's why I think, in spite of all the drama that the church has been involved in, the fundamental role of a religion in a society is positive.
And the church continues to, despite, as you say, these very glaring failures, continues to serve the public good, doesn't it, in very, very important ways. Charities work in Australia is overwhelmingly faith-based.
Yes.
And that looks likely to continue.
Yes. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And that's why if you stop using the word church and start talking about faith-based charities or faith-based schools, huge enthusiasm. I mean, what an irony that at a time when Australians have stopped going to church in droves, they've been enrolling their children in church-based schools in droves. It seems like a contradiction, But I think it points to what you've just said, that people recognize that the expressions of faith, whether in medical care or in social service activity of some kind or in education, is likely to be of a very high standard because it's driven by this faith in the higher being, the higher power.
Hugh, you're also encouraging us to exhibit restraint. Not easy these days, but restraint in consumerism, in technology, to be more moderate, to slow down, to notice things, to notice people.
We're overstimulated. We're all too busy. We even greet each other by saying, "How are you going, Simon? Busy?" As though that would be a virtue instead of foolishness. Yeah. I do think we have to step back and look in the mirror and say, this is out of control. We're consuming too much. We're running too fast. We're not spending enough time in reflection and, as you say, communing with nature and other ways that retain our sanity.
Now, you're of the view that it might take a very serious breakdown for our culture to kind of recognize where we're at and then to start to rebuild it in a more positive direction. There's a kind of destructiveness that comes before a restoration, isn't there? Mm. Is that where your, what I would say, cautious optimism lies?
Yes, partly that. I mean, it's the death and resurrection model in a way, as a metaphor. There often has to be a death of some kind before there's some kind of renewal or reformation. And that might happen. I hope it doesn't, but I think it's likely that politics will have to become more of a shambles. Education levels will have to sink even further. The epidemic of mental illness will have to become even greater before we say, hey, this is now out of control. And that's assuming there isn't some global war or an ecological disaster of some kind. But maybe if that happens, that's what we need. What I'm more optimistic about, though, is that our fundamental humanity, our sense of what it means to be human and the sense of connectedness with other humans will prevail and will be the thing that pulls us back from the brink of a completely self-absorbed disaster.
You spent your life observing these trends, and you certainly have a sense of a real sickness in our culture. What is it that, as you get up every morning, gives you the hope and the optimism that it's possible that things are going to improve?
I'm a great believer in the proposition that the state of the nation starts in my street. And what gives me optimism is when I go for a walk around the suburb I live in, most people are saying hello. My neighbours are terrific. You know, we're not all friends, but we're neighbours, and we know how to be neighbours. We know we've got to keep in touch because if there's a crisis, we're going to need each other. And I think those little signs of people starting to rediscover the serious value of the local neighbourhood is a source of great encouragement.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart. Special thanks to the Sydney Writers Festival for helping us to arrange this interview with Hugh McKay. They also have a podcast series featuring writers like Hugh from the event. You can check them out on swf.org.au. Our website, where you can find this conversation and so much more, is publicchristianity.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. Next week.
I saw the lives of those missionaries and I wanted to be a spinster missionary. I went to Bible college after I finished working with those people. That's where I met my future husband. He was going to be a pastor. And I ended up being what I wanted to be, except not being a spinster.